Well, what a beautiful morning for you all to show up in Salem, Illinois. I'm sorry, I'm struggling here with the volume.
From the north,
from the south, yes, that's right. They shall gather. So I would like to welcome you this morning, wherever you came from. Hoping you'll stay a while. There's some wonderful things in Salem. I hear they make good coffee, but I wouldn't know. Yeah.
You've worked at the coffee shop.
I have been there, yes. I've worked there, okay, yeah. But anyway, that's another story. And it's interesting, you know, several years ago when a number of you were younger, especially the young men, were cheering me on in my resistance against picking up the habit of coffee. But I'm thinking maybe over time it's kind of slid by the way, you know. I'm holding firm. That's right. I survived college without it, okay?
So, you know, what you don't know is that sometimes it shows up in places that you don't expect.
Sometimes the coffee shows up in places I don't expect. Well, you know, that's the way the influence of the world is. It's just anyway, we're so glad to have a great coffee maker with us this morning, Bethany Weaver. Bethany, you're welcome, and I hear you make great coffee. And leaving the topic of coffee entirely, we're also glad to have Lexa Skiles and Christina Bailey. There's a good name for you. Yeah, that's right. And, of course, the Martins. We have another Cullen with us today from Canada. So good to have the Whitakers with us. And all of you are welcome. Good to see Sharon's able to get out continually now and be with us. And some of you have been gone and returned. But anyway, we'll enjoy your presence and fellowship today, I'm sure. We've been studying in Luke and making our way through chapter 11, which I think we'll get out of this morning. It's fascinating over the years to look at the different Gospels and compare them. Sometimes there are some real insights into noticing how they compare among themselves. And I personally probably have spent a lot more time in Matthew than I have in Luke. And so then in doing this Luke study, it makes things stand out that otherwise might not. You know, in the process of learning, there's something to be said for reading things for the first time. Now, we teach memorization, and memorization is good, but one thing that can happen when you're studying the Bible is that you're so familiar with it that when you start the passage, it's like your mind just goes into automatic mode. I know what that says. Therefore, I know what it means. Therefore, what's the next verse, right? And that's not really good. I sometimes try to, if I have a passage that I'm particularly trying to understand, I'll just stay away from it for a while and then come back to it and try to read it like it was for the first time. That's hard to do, but it sometimes can turn on light bulbs in your mind that otherwise you wouldn't be able to turn on. Anyway, here in Luke, we've been looking in particular at this section where Jesus has some very, very strong condemnations for the Pharisees. And that kind of language tends to make people uncomfortable. Language of approval, of love, of affirmation is something that we human beings are typically much more attracted to. You know, if there was only good in the world, it would be enough. You wouldn't need anything else. But in fact, there are things that are bad. There are things that are harmful. There are things that are to be avoided. And sometimes they need to be labeled with very, very strong symbols. You know, if you have a bottle of poison, what typically do you see? Well, you see probably some bright writing on it. You may see a skull and crossbones. That's kind of gruesome, except it seems like in our day it's a celebration to have those kind of things up in your yard and draped from every corner of your property. Normally that's not the way you like to see people, right? You like to see them with flesh on them and not just bones. So bones is a bad sign. It's something you want to watch out for if something will reduce you to that state. Well, in some ways, the strong language that Jesus uses with regard to the behavior and positions of the Pharisees is like placing a symbol of danger that we need to watch out for. And so when you're thinking about the Pharisees, don't just create this image of, well, they're just a bunch of heretics, and yeah, as long as I'm not a heretic, I'm sorry, a hypocrite, as long as I'm, you don't want to be a heretic either, by the way, as long as I'm not a hypocrite, then I'm good to go. But he had some very specific criticisms, as we've noticed in the last two Sundays. So I'm not going to go over those again, but just to kind of tie in with the last of that particular string of sayings that Luke recorded here of Jesus in verse 52 of chapter 11, he says, "Woe unto you lawyers!" And of course, we discussed how that the groupings that Luke uses here, he includes this expression Pharisees, and lawyers seems to be a subdivision of that. He says, "Woe unto you, for you have taken away the key of knowledge. Ye entered not in yourselves, and them that were entering in ye hindered." And I was reflecting this morning on the fact that Jesus didn't say you've taken away the key to knowledge. You've taken away the key of knowledge. And one thing that you encounter when you encounter the Pharisees is the attitude of, we know. We know what the will of God is. We know how you're supposed to live. We know what you're supposed to do and how long you're supposed to do it and in what way. They present themselves as being custodians of the knowledge of God. And, you know, knowledge is a powerful thing. It enables us to do all sorts of things that we otherwise wouldn't be able to do. If as human beings, we hadn't discovered so many, many things about the world we live in, how different would life be for us? We often take it for granted, the amount of technical know-how that puts our world like it is. We sometimes reflect on what would happen if we ever got into a nuclear war and our infrastructure was destroyed. We'd be in bad shape. Some of the most basic things that we just go to Walmart for or go to the auto store for, some things are hard to make yourself. Nobody makes them themselves. There are big machines that make them. There's an incredible amount of technology that goes into making things work and making things work well. And so knowledge is important, and knowledge of God is important. A lot of people in our world think they know something about God. Jesus will be the first to remind us that be sure you know who he really is and what he is like and what he expects, because he is ultimately the one that you'll give account to. And so part of the reason for the energy that Jesus expresses towards the Pharisees is they were the ones who claimed to be holding the knowledge of God. And they looked at Jesus Christ and said to him, the very Son of God, the very God incarnate, and said, "We know you. We know who you are. We know your parents. We know where you came from." And of course, they didn't know anything at all, did they? And so I've been reminded in my life over and over, be careful about what you think you know. Because what the Pharisees thought they knew prevented them from seeing the truth of who Jesus was. And it works that way still today. Something you place in the category of knowledge, make sure it belongs there and examine it carefully. And so I fully understand the energy that Jesus has toward the Pharisees in their claims to knowing, even in the face of God himself. And of course, if you're in that position, you control access to all sorts of things in life. You're the ones that know, right? He says, you prevented those who wanted to enter because knowledge was the key to entering.
Key?
Yes.
It's kind of tricky, isn't it? As far as you get to a certain place in life where you've wrestled with things and you feel like you have a general understanding, but there's always those open palms that, Lord, I believe this is where you are. And it's like you have to stand firm, but also with openness about always being refined in your understanding. You're not wishy-washy, but neither are you the Pharisees that clinch it as though this is it, I have it all perfectly understood. You know, that's kind of it leaves you in a somewhat vulnerable state, but it feels like knowledge because you trust him to show you continually what you need to change or learn better or...
Yes, absolutely. And of course, part of the problem is our accessing knowledge. Now, on the one hand, we would say, well, the Bible is our ultimate source of knowledge, right? It's God revealed. Well, there's only one problem. There is no direct way to get that in here. You know, you can't open it up, pour it in. It's written in a language. There are rules to language. There's meaning to language. Sometimes there are multiple meanings to the same language. And so that process of getting what has been revealed into your mind without you changing it in one way or another through your filters and your experiences is a challenge. And so it's absolutely crucial. I say this to myself and share it with you, that you look very carefully at how you might be creating a narrative for Scripture to fit into, as opposed to letting Scripture create the narrative. We should be very mindful of these kind of processes that human beings go through in this part, in this time of the year, in this time of our history, right? We're in a political year, an election year. And what is the truth? Well, it depends on which ad you listen to, right? We can spin it a lot of ways. Exactly the same facts look to some person like a horrible weakness and to another one like a great strength. Which is it? Well, the same kinds of things can occur with Scripture. The same words can be interpreted in different ways. And so that's not to say you throw up your hands in despair and say there's no truth. There is truth. But you want to start out by making sure that you don't have a spin on it when you start. If you go looking for certain things, you can probably find them. The question is, are you persuaded that the writer of those things meant them that way? Or are you just taking them that way?
And is it not true that, you know, I've wrestled in the past with, God, why is this, the seeking, this searching constant? And I feel like the Scripture teaches us that, Mark, it's refining your character. If you knew, if you had absolute knowledge poured into your head, you'd be God. You know?
Yeah. Now, I had no idea we were going all these places this morning. that's fine. But it gets heavy fast, right? So, yes, when you start talking about knowledge, you realize that from the very beginning, this was what man craved. It was connected with power. in the garden. The temptation was the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Satan said, if you take this, you will know being as gods. Wow, that'd be nice. No wonder it was a temptation. You won't be quiet, which is fine. But that's fine. That's good. But so if we were to, you know, take a shortcut through all the process, it turns out that what God is saying to us as human beings is you don't need to know in that way. You need to trust me because I do know. I know what you can't know. And we don't want to do that, right? I want to know. I want to make my own choices. Because obviously, if I make my own choices, I'll be happy. That's guaranteed. Well, the Pharisees claim to know. Jesus says, you have taken the key of knowledge from others. You haven't entered in yourself. You pretend to be that, but you're not. And so then Luke goes on to tell us some details that begin to occur in the interactions with people. And as he said these things unto them, the scribes and the Pharisees began to urge him vehemently and to provoke him to speak of many things, lying wait for him and seeking to catch something out of his mouth that they might accuse him. My goodness, you would have thought he was running for president. Isn't this so the human way? If you're going to destroy somebody's credibility, you try to find something that comes from them, something they said, something they did, something you can post on a billboard and ruin their reputation so that they have no influence with people. And Jesus had a lot of influence because of the things that he was doing, because of his work with the people, because of his compassion, because of his love, because of his healing. People were following him because he tore down the icons of power that were lording over them. He was very attractive. And so he was a threat to the establishment, and they were trying to find anything they could to destroy him. So Luke 12 then begins like this. In the meantime, when there were gathered together an innumerable multitude of people, insomuch that they trode one upon another, he began to say unto his disciples, first of all. Okay, so did you catch that picture? There's a lot of folks here. How many folks? There's so many they're walking on each other. That's a lot of folks. And of course, this was before the day of amplified sound. And so if you want to be a part of what's going on, if you want to hear what's being said, you got to get close, right? You want the front row or close to it. And so there's a huge press on to get close to where the action is. And so within that huge group then, Jesus addresses his disciples. Kind of an interesting scenario. And of course other people heard. Beware of the leaven of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy. Okay, so talking about a one-liner, this is right up there with the best of them. So what's leaven is yeast, right? So what does yeast do to bread? It gives it its structure, its body, right? Without yeast, bread is pretty much flat, right? Not terribly substantial. So yeast gives body to bread. He says, this is the yeast of the Pharisees. What is it? Hypocrisy. Pretending to be what you're not. That's kind of a put down, wouldn't you say? That's not a compliment. He says, the only thing that makes them look big, the only thing that gives them any shape or substance in your life is the fact that they're pretending to be something that they're not. Ouch. But he continues, there is nothing covered that shall not be revealed, neither hid that shall not be known. Therefore, whatsoever ye have spoken in darkness shall be heard in the light, and that which ye have spoken in the ear in closets shall be proclaimed upon the housetops. Okay, as opposed to the success of this pretense, you may, in fact, pretend to be something you're not. You may, for a while, appear to be significant and substantial. But he says there is nothing that is hidden. There is nothing in pretense that shall not be made known.
Keith?
Yes.
The context, sorry, just going to go back a little bit. Is it your understanding that this conversation is going on while the scribes and Pharisees are blasting him, as if he's ignoring them and talking to his disciples?
So Luke connects it closely with the other chapter, right? So on the one hand, after his direct encounter with them, then they start provoking him, trying to get him to say stuff. And in the meantime, a great crowd gathers. And so then he addresses his disciples undoubtedly in the presence of some of the Pharisees, yes.
I find that somewhat humorous. Here are the religious leaders who demand people pay attention to them. It appears that while they're looking at him, he's talking to his disciples and people gathered around, and they're listening to him instead of the Pharisees and the scribes. That's kind of a funny picture to make. It's a justice, in a sense. And they're stung to the religious leaders.
Yes. Yes. There's a lot of action here. Now, I just want to comment for a minute about a saying like this, where Jesus says, therefore, whatsoever you have spoken in darkness shall be heard in the light, and that which ye have spoken in the ear in closets shall be proclaimed upon the housetops. Okay, so there are lots of ways to communicate with language. And whenever we're dealing with religion and theology, we like for things to be very simple, very literal, very straightforward. This is what it says. We have a word is here. If there's a word is, then the two things on each side of it, the one thing on each side of it is equal, and that's that, right? But are we to take this verse as a prophecy of a specific event? Is there some time whenever everything which has been spoken in the ear in closets will be proclaimed upon the housetops? And if so, which housetops? And when? And where? You see what I'm saying? Is this not an example of using language figuratively to express that there is nothing hid that will not be revealed? It will be revealed. It will be known. Of course, it's already known to God. And presumably at some time in the future, there will be a judgment of all things when all will come to light. But I don't think we're justified in taking this scripture to suggest, okay, this is a prophecy that someday everything that you have said in secret in the closet is going to be shouted on the housetop. You understand what I'm saying? And there's going to be times in scripture when you have to recognize, okay, that I'm not to assume that that's prophesying a specific event. That's a way of communicating that there's nothing hid that will not be known. That's just another way of saying it. And of course, in this particular example, we can all pretty well say, well, yeah, obviously, that's it. Some examples aren't quite that obvious, but nevertheless still true, that they aren't specific prophecies of a specific event. It's a way of communicating a general truth. And so with God, there is no secret closet. There is no hidden facts. There are no unknown events. And all is known by him at all times. Now, you know, if more people really believed that, that would probably change the way they live, do you think? It's generally understood that one of the ways to reduce crime in an area is to install more lights, right? If you got a dark alley, you're much more likely to have things going on that are illegal than if you have it well lit. There's something about realizing that people can see me, that people know what I'm doing, that changes our behavior. Well, I'd really like to tell a lot of people, you know what? God always knows what you're doing. He always sees you. Don't you think your behavior should reflect that? I think it'll change the way you live. Now, fortunately, Jesus also tells us that God's not out to get us, but in fact, he's rooting for us. He wants good for us. He wants us not only to survive, but to thrive in life. And Jesus will bring that up shortly in this discussion. So God's knowledge of us shouldn't be a scary thing if we're trusting in him. Now, if we don't agree with what he wants, if we have our own agenda, then it's a scary thing, right? I don't know about you, but if I know there's a policeman down the road, I make sure of at least two things. Number one, that my seatbelt's fastened, and number two, that I'm going speed limit, because he has the authority and the power to administer remedial action that I prefer to avoid. So anyway, the light and exposure to sight are things which motivate human beings to behave themselves. Well, there is no darkness with God. He knows all. He sees all. Don't ever forget it. It'll change your life. He continues, I say unto you, my friends, be not afraid of them that kill the body, and after that have no more that they can do. But I will forewarn you whom you shall fear. Fear him which after he hath killed hath power to cast in hell. Yea, I say unto you, fear him. Now that passage should really be coupled with the next few verses. Are not five sparrows sold for two farthings, and not one of them is forgotten before God? But even the very hairs of your head are all numbered. Fear not, therefore, you are of more value than many sparrows. Now, Scripture can be confusing if you just read it and run. For instance, in this short span of verses, Jesus tells us to fear. And in particular, he focuses that on the one who hath power to kill and cast in hell. That can be none but God. We are to fear him. And yet, only a few verses later, he says, "Fear not, because you are of more value than many sparrows." Now, which is it? Are we to fear, or are we to fear not? Well, as human beings, the experience of fear has an interesting effect on us. On the one hand, it's typically felt to be a negative thing. I don't like to be afraid. It shuts me down, it paralyzes me, whatever. But one thing it does, the thing that you fear is the thing that elevates as most important in your mind what it is to avoid and to pay attention to. There's the respect element to fear that changes your values. And when Jesus says, "Fear him," notice what he is focusing on. You're fearing him on account of his power, his authority. You're respecting him because he is where the buck stops, as we say sometimes. This is the ultimate intelligence that you're going to have to face. The Pharisees are out here and they may destroy your name. They may put you in jail. They may even kill you. But he says, "You know what? So what? What's higher than that? What's more important than that? Is where you're going to spend eternity. That's where you need to place your values. In comparison to those that can only kill your body, God is so much more important that he is the only one to be feared." But Jesus couples this all with this remarkable comparison of value. Now, in Matthew's gospel, a similar passage occurs. And in Matthew's gospel, we have that two sparrows are sold for one farthing. Luke has five sparrows for two farthings. So one gets thrown in for free, right? Quantity matters even in the Bible. If you're purchasing power. But notice here why Jesus deals with this. Not one of them is forgotten. In the purchasing process, you get one for free. It doesn't even count. So five instead of two, and yet you only double the price. But with God, even the free one is not forgotten before God. He continues, "Even the very hairs of your head are all numbered. Fear not, therefore, you are of more value than many sparrows." So even though in the Greek the same word phobos is used in both of those verses, the focus is different. So the fear him from verse 5 is a focus on what is the most significant value, what deserves the greatest respect in your mind. How should you most alter your behavior on on account of? It's because of God. He should feel that part. In these later verses, Jesus assures us that while this is true, while as human beings we order things in our lives by the things that we fear, and God should be at the top of that, we should also recognize that this is a God who, while he is supreme, yet he cares intensely about us. That's the kind of knowledge we need, right? The Pharisees, they know all about how to get ceremonially clean and how much tithe to pay on your garden and your herbs. This is the kind of knowledge that can only come from above. We really wouldn't have a clue that God cares about things as he does if it weren't for Jesus, would we? Have you ever thought about that? If you're looking for things to be thankful of in your life, be thankful for the God that Jesus reveals. The loving Father. Now, I want to make one other observation here about the language. When I reflect on our world and when I reflect on this congregation, knowing that some of you I know fairly well, some of you I don't know at all, but knowing that all of us have come from different backgrounds and a whole host of voices and influences and ideas that have been generated and intermingled over the past 2,000 years since Jesus was here, and it just sort of makes my head spin when I think about it. But one of the ideas that has come out in the thoughts of men is the idea that of necessity God must will all things in a direct way. And so you'll read commentaries that reflect on these verses in this way. That what it's saying is that the sparrows, not one of them is disposed of unless God consents. The word consent is, or wills, is inserted there. Notice it's not there. It says they're not forgotten. God knows. God sees. There's a difference. It does not infringe on God's sovereignty to suggest that he has created a world which operates in a way that he has dictated in general without him having to consent to the death of every bird. It's an incredible world, quite frankly. It's amazing the number of self-regulating systems and cycles there are in our world. It's hard for it to get too far out of balance. There are these, in engineering we talk about feedback loops. And so if in a given system you get too much of anything, a feedback loop allows it to restrain what's coming in. Something that perhaps you all can relate to is we have a feedback loop back here on our commodes, which you can be very grateful for. So when you flush the commode, water starts entering the tank, full blast. Now, if that goes on forever, we're going to have a problem, right? There's going to be water everywhere. But there's a little float in there that as the water rises, the float comes up gradually, and on the other end of the float is a little plunger which shuts a valve off. And so that's called a negative feedback loop. And so it controls the process by responding to the input. Now, the man who created that, I don't know who it was, but he created something which works automatically, if the float continues to float and doesn't get hung up on the side, and if the valve doesn't stick. Okay, so but within certain reason, it works automatically. He doesn't have to will that to happen every time it happens. It just works. It doesn't negate the fact that he created it in the least. It just works. And we have every reason to think that there are all sorts of things that God has created that just work without him having to sovereignly direct the raindrop to fall in a certain place or the bird to die or not to die. Or if we're going to get really specific, I suppose we could talk about the bacterium to reproduce or not reproduce or to infect or not to infect or the atom to split or the electron. I mean, how far are we going to go, right? How much attention does God have to give to his universe in order to make it work? Or did he just make it so it works? And that's good enough for me. So, there again, why would you read that into this passage? Why would you insert consent only to bolster your point of view, some idea that you want to impose on it? Because it doesn't say consent. It says that God knows. Things are operating after a fashion, after the fashion that they were created in. And so I don't think if you're losing your hair, you should say, well, you know, God's counting them and he's apparently not wanting me to have so many or whatever. No, I don't think you should go there. I think that you are part of his creation and you may well have inherited genes which result in you losing those hairs at a certain age. And that's okay. Because that's not the part of you that really matters, even though it may matter very much to you. At the end of the day, the question is, do you trust him to have done all things for the good? And so Jesus says, on the one hand, he needs to be at the very height of your respect. You should fear him above all others. But don't forget, you don't need to fear that he's out to get you or that he has any ill designs on you because he knows you intimately. And Jesus will also say he cares. I see again, that's something that's good to know. Okay, you guys are pretty quiet this morning. Now that Lars stopped talking. any questions, comments you'd like to make? This is Sunday school, and so all those kind of things are welcome. Okay, well, we got time for another verse, I think. Jesus says also, I say unto you, whosoever shall confess me before men, him shall the Son of Man also confess before the angels of God. But he that denieth me before men shall be denied before the angels of God. Now, here's another one of those verses where Luke has a slightly different wording from Matthew. So in Matthew's gospel, Jesus is recorded as saying, whosoever shall confess me, him also will I confess before my Father, which is in heaven. So Luke here includes the bigger audience of the angels. Now, this is really a pretty hard verse to translate in my mind. This word confess. The Greek word here comes from or is connected with a noun which means to be of one mind with, or the one-mindedness. This is a verb form. And so maybe literally you do something like to say the same thing here. So it clearly is pointing to the union of two. And so if you think about human beings and their relationship to Jesus and how they might respond to his teaching and his life, it really is about how we compare to him. It is about how we relate to him. It is about how we're connected to him. And there is a very strong social pressure on us as human beings to be accepted in our peer group, in our world. I don't know if you've ever had the privilege of going to public school or the curse, but it really is a world of dog-eat-dog when it comes to acceptance, when it comes to popularity. And there's always somebody who is trying to tear you down to elevate themselves. And there are all sorts of mechanisms that are used to climb on top of other people. And so there is the temptation just to fit in, just to go along. And I don't know if you've noticed yet, but that's not something that Jesus did. Jesus didn't just fit in. He was here on a mission. He was the source of all truth. And he didn't hesitate to proclaim it in his world, even if it contradicted those who were highly esteemed by others. And he tells us here, those who connect with me in this way, who share with me my message, my life, my influence, those are the ones that I will share with in the world to come. That's an important message. You know, if you're looking for basic baseline facts about our relationship with God, he is calling us here to a life which doesn't just fit in with the world around us. Now, that's not to say that we go out and try to be different than everybody else. The objective is not being different. The objective is being like him, right? I always sort of enjoy the fact when I can make some connections with people who are different from me, something we can talk about or reflect on. It's enjoyable to make connections. But there should never be the time whenever I allow that desire or drive to overcome my connection to him and my representation of him to others. So if you're looking for important building blocks in your knowledge, in your understanding of what Christianity is all about, I think you have to say this is one of them. Okay, thank you. You've been a very well-behaved class this morning. And mostly quiet. I will recommend you for whatever.
All my days, shine.